So we're just going to talk a little bit about the history of QB and who did what and how you guys did it all. Let's start with, where did the idea for QB come from? Christian, do you want to start with that?
Yeah, my pleasure, John. Yeah, so circa 2007, working in a bank at that time, largely on equity derivatives and a little bit of electronic futures, saw a lot of adoption of equity algorithmic agency adoption from the buy side, and with increased interest in that of smart order routing on the equity options side, conversations with that hedge fund community started to unearth quite consistent requests of, this is great for equities and equity derivatives, these algorithmic engineering or agency products solutions. Can you solve this execution challenge and reduce our slippage and automate our executions through algorithms outside of equities? And so that's a crude way of summarizing some of the origins behind the idea that formed QB. And obviously, part of that formation included conversations had with Robert, who I was working with at that time in his quantitative head of strategy and research capacity for the equities markets. And I can hand it to Rob as to what validation of that opportunity yourself.
Yeah, no, it's Christian, it's exactly what you said. We were both at the bank doing, I mean, you were in derivatives, I was in the electronic execution and equities. And if you remember, we were both attracted to that bank by the promise of doing cross-asset trading, at least I was. Turns out inside a bank, you hit some obstacles when you try to take your business into other asset classes. And as Christian said, we had been hearing from clients that equities are great, but what about, I remember very vividly, what about fixed income? We have nothing in fixed income. We don't know what it's costing. We wouldn't know what to do about it if we did. Can't you do something? And this had been, this was 2005 to 2008. It was the time that algorithmic execution and equities went from sort of being a new thing to being completely standard. And it was Christian, I remember, came into my office and said, hey, we should go do this. And I was like, what? Start a company? Are you crazy? He's like, no, we can do it. And we set out to do it. And our mission from the beginning was agency algorithmic execution in interest rates. We started with interest rate futures. We specifically started with euro dollar and treasury futures because the microstructure was more different than anything that people were doing currently. We figured that the existing equity players would start probably with equity index futures and FX, and it would take them a while to get to strange exotic products like euro dollars. So we went straight there and started with those products on CME. Then we did, I think, Eurex rates derivatives, Eurex and Life. And then by customer demand, we expanded to other futures, other asset classes, and expanded from there. And then we also, we never lost our original focus, which was rates. So we're doing US treasuries pretty much, you know, around the world, all the products that we can do.
So walk me through the creation of the company. You guys both leave the bank at the same time, or you'd leave one at a time? Did you get some venture funding? How did you do it?
So I remember, if I can jump in just to say something. So we started, it turned out to have been the worst time in a generation to try to start a company. It was early 2008, but I remember thinking, raising capital, why would that take as long as 6 weeks? Seems pretty obvious. The idea is obviously a great idea. I'm sure we'll go talk to people. They'll give us money. We'll be running inside of a month, tops. Didn't exactly work out that way.
Yes. No, it was, I was going to ask, is this podcast PG rated or R rated? It was certainly a baptism of entrepreneurial fire that we encountered. After the third failed term sheet, I turned to someone and said, is this normal? Or like one failed term sheet's not even normal. So anyway, we persevered, and it took us a year and a half in that environment to get the funding. But in the meantime, we were able to continue to progress the concept and leverage good relationships in the wonderful futures and derivatives community.
Yeah.
And they helped us and encouraged us and egged us on, so to speak, into the abyss. And then, you know, once we got the funding, it took about 11 months before we were able to support our first client trade. Recall from memory, it was a 45 lot euro dollar order. We had 50 cents commission at that stage, and we certainly spent more than the $22.50 that night celebrating. But it was a big moment, and you know, to have our brokerage licenses and connection to the CME, and as Rob said, a lot of progress since then. Various, you know, Series B, Series C, and most recently our strategic transaction partnership with Deutsche Börse Group, as we're at a much more evolved and mature stage, as Rob said, multi-asset and finally actually getting into some of the grander vision components around the likes of even interest rate swaps and government bonds, obviously US treasuries, but other denominations as well, and options on futures, also a very good and healthy growing part of our business. So we're very fortunate to have gotten here, but it's definitely a story of persistence for sure.
So what licenses did you have to pursue in order to be able to execute this business?
Yeah, so we were already as individuals and always had been on the agency side. And then that's an important part here is people were often saying, you know, with this sort of quantitative approach in 2007, 2008, why don't you become a hedge fund or a prop trading group? And Rob and I were like, well, we've never worked on that side of the business. Yeah. We're the agency side. So we were already licensed as individuals. So we, as a first registration, became an independent introducing broker and operated under that. That allowed us to receive commissions and partner with the banks, as we've successfully done over the years. And then once we matured beyond some of the major futures exchanges and cash treasuries on the interdealer bank platforms was asked and requested by our client base, we registered as a broker-dealer for government bonds and the associated registrations there, and great compliance officer that we have, now our COO, joined us. And we've always operated what we thought and we think is appropriately as a registered entity. So we're held to all the best execution standards that update from time to time under both regulatory groups. And it gives assurances to our clients and also, you know, subjects us to certainly audits and financial capital, net capital requirements. But we feel that's the best practice, and I think the clients get reassurance from us holding those standings.
So as an introducing broker, you don't actually hold any customer accounts. You just have...
Yeah, that's good point of clarification. Unfortunately, when we looked at the registration options, we could either become an FCM, and we were never a clearing group.
Millions and millions of capital.
Or we could become an independent introducing broker, because there was no algorithmic broker license that they could wrap their heads around or certainly had. So after a lot of liaison with the commission, or the NFA, we said we'll register as an independent introducing broker, even though obviously we're a very modern business model in that we're an algorithmic engineering group of nearing or about 70 people globally, offices around the world, New York, London, Singapore, and India. But we offer our services as exactly that, a transaction-based solution, centrally hosted by us, accessible from any front end. But every order that we receive is all electronic. There's no voice handling. It's all electronically submitted from the client's EMS, OMS, the TTs, the Bloombergs, etc., and routed to us. And then we route down as an electronic agent through any of their FCM partners or choices into that exchange. That FCM is the executing broker per se, and naturally the default initial clearer, we're just registered as the electronic agent on that workflow or audit trail, as the exchanges refer to it.
Yeah. We considered, I think, the possibility of only being a software vendor and not registering, but we wanted to meet the higher standard of being registered for you know, standard for ourselves and also for client comfort. So we don't, you know, so we have anti-money laundering trading and so on, even though we don't hold any customer money. We do all of that.
So as you got started, who were some of your first clients in terms of categories? Were they hedge funds? Or
they were brave. They were brave. When I think back, the first people who put a trade through, because we're like, we're just an agent. See if it works.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They, another way that we refer to them, legends for sure, but we refer to them as very like-minded. Again, this was 2009, John, and his Rob and Christian with a very nice PowerPoint, a freshly inked license, a lot of energy and passion, but unproven really in the production sense, going to these CTAs, very well-known names, and we're still in good contact with them still to this day, and still thank them to, you know, solicit them to be our first clients and first users of our algorithmic offering. And I think we started maybe with, you know, four or five targeted clients. By the time it got to the finish line and the readiness of when we were ready and they were able to fix connect to us, we had it down to two. And they submitted those first initial orders. Admittedly, it was in euro dollars. Pretty low volatility, hopefully very low risk. I'm sure that was part of their calculus, but that worked fine for us as well. And then it's been a refining journey ever since, and always a case of working closely with those and our clients today on further evolutions, constantly changing and releasing and partnering on that with them on research or insights and workflow challenges or needs that they have on their side.
Yeah. Back in those days, agency execution in futures was not a thing that was offered. The FCMs were just making the money off clearing. And literally they told us, I don't know if you remember, we went to talk to the head of futures at one of the big banks, and he's like, there's nothing quantitative to do in futures. It's just a clearing business. And so their attitude was, if the customers want algorithms, they can just write their own. We'll provide the pipes. So we actually, some of the easier firms for us to talk to were ones that had their own internal algo groups, because they understood, they got what it was. So we would go in and say, this is what it is. Put us against yours.
So
but
what
it was not, the agency did not exist.
So what were some of the first algos like that you were offering? What kind of algos were people looking for?
Yeah, so
arrival price, yeah.
Yeah, right. I think the very hot concept and also most appropriate and somewhat credentialed initial product was our Bolt algorithm, which was arrival price. Again, had those credentials, I think, because thankfully Rob had been known and synonymous with a framework and approach, the Neil Chris, Almgren Chris model. He partnered with Neil Chris on, was heavily utilized in the equity space. And that naturally we felt had a good application and a use case in the futures market, as Rob said, which hadn't been seen before, at least from an agency provider. Some people, quantitative hedge funds, may have been trying to build this or were building this in-house for their own flow or usage exclusively. We were always looking to build such a solution, innovate, and provide the first arrival price algorithm to the marketplace as a common service. And that was our Bolt algorithm. I think we launched with four algorithms, Bolt for arrival price, Strobe, which does TWAP and VWAP. And what else? I think Might have just been those two, actually, to start.
I think it would have been just those. And I don't think we had the framework for volume curves until a few years into it. We had some approximate, some approximate thing.
Yeah. So it's very, obviously, it's, you know, along the journey, it's very iterative, evolving in, you know, the adoption of new technologies and access to new data sets and trying and trialing those to further evolve and smarten the offering for sure.
So what were some of the problems that you ran into in those early days?
I'll stage a few things. Rob can speak to certainly some of them. Access to information was less documented. So there was actually many cases where we would have the privilege of some FaceTime with various exchange engineers to explain how actually the engines worked or did not work. That was critical. I think the exchanges have gotten a lot better at documenting that and policing fair and equitable access for everyone to that information. I know another topic which you can speak to, Rob, is probably that of the UAT environments versus that of out-of-run simulations.
Well, I tell the story when I give talks about this. We wrote some agents to test our algorithms and submitted orders into the CME UAT environment, which is a dummy version of their match engine. And two things happened. One was it wasn't realistic enough to develop the algos, but the other was the CME literally phoned us and said, stop abusing our test environment. You're overloading it. It's not designed for that. And the other, as Christian said, I mean, getting the information, you know, we started out specializing in Eurodollars, and our policy was to understand everything about the match engine, which for Eurodollars is pretty complex. I mean, rest its soul, it's all gone now, but the rules for implication and for the pro rata matching. And we literally flew to Chicago and got a meeting in the room with the guy who wrote the match engine. And that was the only way. And to give credit to the exchanges, it wasn't that it was secret. It's just that it's such a complex topic. And they wrote it, you know, they wrote it and didn't document it. It wasn't just because it's so complex. But talking to the person who wrote it, we would understand things like butterfly middle leg, you know, the fact that those things produce implied quotes at the midpoint, essentially. And the nuances of what butterflies imply, what spreads imply. We were really all over that. And the life matching engine, there was that weird thing. They have this weird interpolated pro rata. I was going to mention also with our regulatory status, I think at one point Eurex told us we were the only firm in our category. They either had clearing members or prop traders, but they had no one else like us. They really didn't know what to do with us.
That's great. So as you were building this technology, what was the thought process on the technology to use, the language to use, and have you changed it over time?
Yeah, I mean, it's been evolving. I'll speak to that. We started with FlexTrade. So it's a good, it's a good platform. It's very widely used. We had been using it at Bank of America. It really got us going. It was not designed for futures. So we started hitting just some of the issues with symbology. I mean, they've probably improved this because they're always improving it, but things like symbols with spaces in them were a challenge. And so we then wrote our own trading engine. So it was about a one-year project called the TE, the trading engine, with very intensive testing, and then ported our algorithms from FlexTrade to our internal engine. And that's pretty much what we've been using ever since. The front end, we have a GUI, which has been reworked since then. And the exchange data connectors have been reworked several times. But the heart of the match engine, I'm not the match engine, but the algorithmic engine, it's what we wrote.
And then Rob, the data sets or the databases and environments have largely always been in KDBQ.
They've always been in KDB. So our first hire, Mahendra Reddy, said, look, guys, I know this is expensive, but you know, I and people that work with me are going to be so much more productive. So we've been a KDB user since the beginning. Yeah. And we have, you know, we've been through several generations of our database design, but it's all in there.
Yeah. And today we have 70 people compared to the 6 we started with. So we have maybe even just as many people working just on data as we did in the entire company when we started.
Yeah, yeah.
Processes and professionalism and documentation and scale of everything. It's just,
No, so the trading system is in C++. We use R for all the analytics. People nowadays are using Python. A lot of our young people want to use Python, but we have a big established code base in R. And then we use KDB across the company.
Are there some anecdotes from use cases with with clients that are particularly fun or interesting as they started to use your technology?
I mean, we've got lots of them. Yes. One that jumps the top of mind was one client we went to see. We said, "Okay, what benchmark do you want to use?" And he's like, "Yeah, we don't really do benchmarks. We just want good execution." And we're like, "Okay, I mean, we can optimize to whatever you want, but what would that consist of?" He's like, "Yeah, just good. Actually, give me the best price you can." So we had to translate that into a quantitative formulation, because with algo trading, you have to program something. So that was a discussion that we had.
I also remember a conversation. We'd been courting a very large systematic hedge fund, and they gave us an opportunity to, I think it might have been simulations or maybe it was some production trades. I'm a bit foggy. It was a long time ago now, but we did this body of work. They wanted to then step back, revisit it. We did the analysis. They did it and we had the follow-up call, and they, you know, evidenced even with their own quantitative analysis that, you know, we were outperforming their internal offering. And say, you know, as meaning saving mm-hmm. money in the magnitude of, call it, you know, $1.50 or $2, but they were not going to proceed. And I think we got a little bit emotional, kind of almost yelling at them, like, what, you know, don't you get it? Like that is the economic return compared to obviously also the cost of you building it yourselves. And anyway, turns out, you know, confronting them in that meeting had some risk, but they appreciated it and did reverse their decision, and to this day are a great large client of ours and still realizing the benefits. So yeah you have funny interactions like that, which you know, as your own founders of your own product and business, you're myopic and very acutely aware and attuned to, you know, what the value proposition is exactly. And mm-hmm. it's never a surprise now that people don't naturally see it necessarily like that on the surface. It takes a little bit of conversation to get them to appreciate the value proposition
See. I remember two other anecdotes connected with our historical simulator. So one, we did a bunch of simulated executions to compare against actual trades they had done. And they came back and said, yeah, you know, you're not really outperforming as long as we exclude these two outliers that we traded. And we're like, well, did you actually trade those? Like, yeah, we lost a lot of money, but, you know, those are, and we're like, yeah, well, so we have guards against that. That's why when we, you know, we would not have had those outliers. So they were convinced by that. And then another one, we did some simulations and they said, okay, we understand your stuff about, you know, capping the things that run away. But what about this particular time period? It was, I think, July of a year earlier when the market suddenly had strongly directional behavior where instead of reverting, how would your algorithms have behaved then? And we were able to say, okay, we'll go back and run those orders at that time and see what they would have done. And it turned out they would have worked pretty well. So we were usually able to answer, you know, to answer those kind of questions.
So Christian, you were the first CEO of the company, correct? And then
that's correct, yes.
And then at one point you stepped down from that role and you hired a new CEO, and then you stepped back into the CEO role. So can you kind of walk me through the progression of the CEO role and how that evolved over the time frame?
Sure. I've obviously, as a founder and a young one, I guess, at the start of this venture, taken that title. And thanks to the support of Rob and others, yeah, it's definitely been a learning curve for me. And this entrepreneurial path has seen us experience many different stages that companies go through. And for those that know me, I straddle between opposite ends of the world. Mm-hmm. My family, born here and lived here for some time, we've relocated to Australia and the furthest part of Australia, Perth. And so some that know me know how many miles and how much travel and time zone challenges or accommodations that involves. And, you know, as we've grown the company and it's global in its geographies and its client base, not just its employees, we've always looked at how can we further better proceed and structure the company as it relates to the management. And obviously New York's a key center for us and continues to be so. And so look, without speaking to any particular details, you know, we have and we did transition and definitely supported that initiative to bring in a new CEO. And it turned out the timing in which we looked to have a change was just before the pandemic. And obviously, you know, I was actually here in my reinstated title as CEO just prior to the pandemic. I questionably may have actually had COVID at that point in time as well. And I think in March of 2020, quickly raced back to my family and was, without exaggeration, locked in there for the better part of what was nearly a year and a half. So obviously now it looks like the market and business functions are returning to the way that they used to be, and travel and in-person meetings accordingly. So another exciting new stage for us as a company and the market, and you know, further work for us to do in that regard. Not just for me as CEO, but as a board member, we're always looking to further evolve the company.
You guys also brought in Tom Asher as the chairman of the company. Mm-hmm. He had been, I think, a consultant or something, or a board member, and then you asked him to be the chairman. What has Tom brought to the equation for you guys?
Yeah, so obviously Tom's a well-known and seasoned veteran. I think you'll allow me to use that term, in the derivatives markets himself, but also has and always had a very good experience and track record on small company M&A activities. And he joined us, I think, at an appropriate time where we were private equity backed and looking obviously for and high growth as always, and looking to position for and handle various opportunities in that regard. And was instrumental in those conversations and in one sense, the Deutsche Börse outcome. Obviously, Tom played a role in that regard as well. And, you know, for me personally, been able to draw a lot from Tom and his experiences, obviously in my capacity as CEO, reporting to him and as the executive chairman, but, you know, in partnership also on the board. And he continues to be a great advisory to not just me, but others in the organization, and a local presence as well, where physically, mm-hmm. Certainly during the pandemic, I wasn't physically able to be here. Tom could certainly play a great role in that regard. So it's been a great pleasure and really good teamwork having him as part of our unit.
All right. So last question for you. So what is the future of QB? Where are you guys headed?
I'll talk a little bit maybe about the strategic initiatives that we're really excited about, and maybe Rob can speak to some of the content or the technical expertise. He's the Q and I'm the B here, so we'll stick to our roles. So big picture, John, we're super excited, and we've invested heavily over the last 2+ years during the pandemic and definitely through till today in expansion, not just advancements in our futures algo performance, which Rob can talk a little bit to the science behind techniques and advances we're making there, but in terms of new asset classes that further complement and relate to futures, options on futures. We have a new algorithm, Striker, which has performed exceptionally well at handling most complex option structures and trading within the displayed bid-offer spread and auto-handling delta unwinds, just really complex manual things perhaps some people do. We've fully automated and perfected with Striker, so that's been going great guns. We also, as Rob mentioned, have been in the cash treasury on the runs for some time. People would refer to this as the CLOB markets, BrokerTec, CME BrokerTec, DealerWeb's eSpeed, or TradeWeb's DealerWeb, Fenix, Liquidity Edge. Those CLOBs, we've got a smart order router on now, Prism. We're seeing great uptake of that and application for that with the banks in-house, believe it or not, but obviously also through some partnerships with the buy side. And then in addition to that, we are supporting Basis, that we've had leg up as a RV strategy across futures products for some time. Most recently, we've seen a lot of demand and been delivering, perfecting Ledger on Basis, leveraging Prism on the cash, and obviously, you know, what we do with futures algorithmically on the other side of that transaction. And then last but not least, we have been increasingly servicing what's really exciting, transactions on the OTC interest rate swap and government bond markets. People may scratch their head and wonder, this is absolutely first mover delivery from us, same as what we did in futures back in 2009. This was always part of the vision, and it's a really exciting space that we're really excited to be talking to clients about. And it seems the demand is pretty significant for them automating and smartening how they transact their OTC, RFQ, RFS transactions. So that kind of, and in addition to the FX market as well, as Rob may have mentioned, that really starts to fulfill our vision, all things non-equity, so to speak, and then hopefully ultimately ability to do structures and packages intelligently through Ledger across all of those asset classes is what we're either partly solving today or expect to further solve in not too far a distance from now. So big picture, that's it. I will hand to Rob.
Yeah. So just, you know, to summarize very quickly, I would say two things. One is continuing to raise our game in terms of trading on order books. So your traditional futures limit order books. So improving the quantitative techniques, the machine learning and the volume modeling and the trying to sort of make the strategies more quantitatively grounded with, of course, always a mix of intuition, but trying to improve the quantitative underpinnings of that. And then the other part, as Christian said, is extending algorithmic trading into markets where it has not been traditionally used. So the private order books in the treasury markets, the request for quotes, even things like options, it's very complex because there are hundreds of strikes interacting. And the structures are just not something that people are used to trading electronically. I remember people saying, you know, when I joined Bank of America, our boss said, okay, your challenge is to figure out how to trade small cap stocks because people think you can't do it with algos. Then we went to futures. People said algorithmic trading in futures is not a thing. So we went out to do it. And I think the frontier now is the things like the private liquidity pools and the request for quotes and those markets with more complex structure, figuring out how to do that algorithmically and optimally. That's what I'm most excited about.
All right, I misspoke. I do have one more question.
Okay.
And that is, you guys did the equity deal with Deutsche Börse. What has that brought to the equation for you? What are the synergies with them? And have they provided any direction for you? Or, you know, what's the support?
Yeah, great question. Look, first and foremost, they bring obviously a lot of institutional firepower, brand awareness, and strategic positioning for us that, to be clear, maintains our independence, if that makes sense. you know, we're not private equity owned now. We have a long-term view and positioning and roadmap. And obviously, yeah, you know, the reassurance of one of the biggest institutions in our space. They are multi-asset. And as you've heard today, so are we increasingly. So there's definitely been various strategic benefits, insights, and guidance that they've been able to provide as we've looked to navigate best paths to market. You know, an example, just one of many, could be the 360T FX business that they also own as part of their portfolio. That's allowed us to have really direct and insightful conversations around that market with obviously a leading platform and mutual client bases that we can naturally collaborate on, both being under the Deutsche Börse umbrella. That's been very strategically valuable to us. There's certainly also domain experts at various levels, even infrastructurally, operationally, et cetera, that we've had the benefit of now tapping into from the Deutsche Börse group, on rotations, et cetera, not to mention the sales and marketing events and efforts that they naturally have across that. And they look at continuing to also expand in their family of businesses. There's a proposed recent announcement of a proposed transaction with the SimCorp entity that may, and certainly if it's successful, would bring other further synergies for us in terms of distribution reach. And so there's definitely a long-term vision and strategy here, of which we are a key piece. And there's certainly obviously more to come in that regard. I know, Rob.
Yeah, no, it's that they're in our business. They do what we do. They get it.
All right. So I got the final question for you, which is a fun one. What is the best or most fun piece of swag that you guys have ever had as a company?
For me, it's Gillet.
The best.
I think just, you know, funny little story, but obviously we have to work within the $100 unit price limit per person. We were certainly doing various pieces of swag along the way, but I think I was walking past a Uniqlo store, you know, some 10 years ago, and saw one of these vests in the window and tried it on, quite liked it, and then challenged one of our team members to see if we could buy 100 of them and get it embroidered for all $100. Anyway, we did, and we got them out there, and they were a raving success. So we couldn't move that product quick enough. If only we had charged for it. It was a hot seller.
I have a pair of socks I think I've never dared to wear. They're kind of garish.
Yes, industry socks are a very, very hot
The socks and the Gillet are opposite ends of the stylist.
We'll get you a pair.
Yeah, my son had a pair of socks from some vendor at the recent OIC conference that he was he was rocking them. So
yep, good.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you very much
for your time today. It was great speaking to you and learning more about quantitative brokers and its history and its future. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, John.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure.